The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, the only career advice you'll ever need. The contentment of being true to yourself comes through doing good work and doing it with love. This is written by Arthur C. Brooks. When we are stuck on a hard problem, it usually isn't because we can't find the answer. It's that we don't even know the right question. Imagine that you are trying to figure out how fast food can make you healthier. You are overlooking the right first question, which is whether fast food can do this. That is precisely the problem with agonizing over finding the right job and career. What am I supposed to do to find a career that makes me happy is not the right first question. The right first question is, who am I? Only after we answer that can we understand our needs and desires, and only that understanding can allow us to get on with the serious business of what we are supposed to do with our life. According to legend, the dictum, know thyself, was carved into the stone of the temple of Apollo at Delphi in ancient Greece. At around the same time, the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu wrote in the Tao Te Ching, knowing the self is enlightenment. What these thinkers in the ancient world meant was that all knowledge must start with self-knowledge. Yet, again and again, social scientists find that we don't know ourselves as well as we think we do. Studies based on survey data show that we don't always accurately perceive the impression we make on others, nor does our self-perception consistently match how others see us. And we are not great at assessing our own abilities. Part of this ignorance of ourselves derives from cognitive biases and a defensive need to place ourselves in the best possible light. So we remember things we did well, but we forget what we did poorly. We also tend to overestimate our skills, especially when, in fact, we're incompetent, and we think we're smarter than we are. Knowing ourselves demands efforts that goes beyond simply observing our behaviors and tastes, or even listening to what others tell us about ourselves. It requires a process of discernment, of looking for deeper meaning. The ancient Greek word for this is sunesis. The Buddhists call it prajna. When turned inward, it is a mystical journey into the nature of the self. The metaphysical inquiry can lead to unexpected answers. For example, the Buddhist answer to the question of the self is that it is an illusion. Not that you don't exist, but that you don't exist in the absence of others. A famous Zen Buddhist koan asks, what is the sound of one hand clapping? One solution to this riddle is that any sound would be an illusion. It would only become real if you added your other hand to make the clap. It's a metaphor for the self without others. Your individual existence in isolation is empty. It is made full only by the presence of other people. From this proposition naturally flows the answer to the question, what am I supposed to do if I want to be happier? Love others. This is the only way to experience compassion and harmony with oneself. My own Catholic tradition goes about answering the self question differently, but it comes to a similar conclusion. A direct response to who am I occurs in the book of Genesis. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness. So who is God? In the New Testament, the apostle answers, God is love. The natural follow-up question is, what is love? To which St. Thomas Aquinas provides the most compelling resolution in his Summa Theologiae. To love is to will the good of the other. Tying this all together, you might say that God is pure will to love the other. So what am I created to do? Love others. Contrary to modern thinking, Neither Aquinas nor the Buddhists suggest in any way that love involves feelings. It is a matter of will, which, according to most religions and philosophies, is also a matter of free will. From this, it also follows that although we are created to love others, we don't always live up to this natural design. I fail at this myself, I know, because some people are hard for me to love. That's why love is a commitment, not a feeling. As you set out to earn your daily bread, what does it mean to exist to love others? Are you supposed to renounce all worldly goods? I don't think so. Consider these words by the early 20th century Lebanese-American writer Gahil Kilbran from his poem On Work. Often have I heard you say, as if speaking in sleep, he who works in marble and finds the shape of his own soul in the stone is nobler than he who plows the soil. Work is love made visible. And if you cannot work with love, but only with distaste, it is better that you should leave your work and sit at the gate of the temple and take alms of those who work with joy. What I take from this Gibran is this: you are made to love, and your work, no matter what it is, should be the way you express your love. That might sound as if being ambitious or hard-working doesn't matter so long as we have a heart full of love. But that's not the implication. To love others through our work involves bringing our very best effort every day, to be completely, uncompromisingly dedicated to excellence in what we do. Whether we work in a bank, or put roofs on houses, or take care of children full-time, true love means not cutting corners. Excellence is not separate from love, not a modern free market addendum to the will of the divine. Back in Genesis, after creating man and woman in his image, what did God say? He said it was very good. Self, love, and excellence, all brought together. This takes us full circle to the natural anxiety about finding a job that meets your passion. What should you do? Again, that's the wrong first question. Ask yourself instead how you can go about doing with love and excellence whatever work comes your way. Take opportunities as they arise, recognizing that the job you are in is simply the available means to love and to be excellent. And if you cannot achieve excellence in that job or do it with love, then, if you can, leave it quickly. If finding the perfect job is not important, why does everyone worry about it so much? We can blame our parents or our culture or our economy, but the true answer is a short circuit in our reasoning. We start with a very plausible set of assumptions. When I find my unique sense of purpose in my work, then I will be successful at what I do, and when I am successful, I will be happy. This seems entirely rational, but it commits a crucial error. It assumes that worldly success brings happiness. That is simply not true. Any amount of research shows that pursuing success, whether you count that in money, power, or prestige, usually leads to less happiness, especially when the pursuit crowds out human relationships. It lowers satisfaction by putting you on the hedonic treadmill of never having enough. It makes you a success addict. That doesn't mean you have to choose between success and happiness. It means you need to have the right goal. What social scientists find is that people who pursue their happiness also become more successful. So shoot for happiness first at work, and success will follow. How to find happiness at work? It so happens that a very good strategy for finding happiness in work is to strive for excellence and love. Excellence at work is sometimes called earned success, a mixture of effort and accomplishment that in turn enhances your job satisfaction and commitment to a career. Love here takes the form of serving others, which again underpins the deep fulfillment that work can bring. Whom we serve varies. It might be our customers, our colleagues, or the public. But dedicating your work to the good of others can make what might have been the most imperfect job into a perfect moral mission. You need only two pieces of navigational equipment on that mission: the love in your heart and the will to be excellent. If you have those, you will find the answer to the question, who am I? You will find satisfaction, and you will make our world a better place. This column is adapted from a commencement speech delivered on May 13, 2023, at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. Our second article is from the science section of the May 2023 issue. The title of this article is, "This Lawsuit Could Change How the Forest Service Fights Wildfires." Fire retardant is toxic to fish. An Oregon nonprofit is arguing that it shouldn't be used at all. And this article was written by Kylie Moore. On a hot, dry August day in 2002, air tankers swooped over a small wildfire south of Bend, Oregon. The Forest Service hoped to suppress the flames by dropping at least 1,000 pounds of fire retardant on and around the fire. But the pilots missed. Instead, the red liquid cascaded into the nearby Fall River, a tributary of the Deschutes. Soon after, at least 22,000 trout died, virtually all the fish living in a six-mile stretch. Fire retardant contains ammonium phosphate, which is highly toxic to fish. In the years following the accident, Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics, FSEEE, a nonprofit based in Eugene, Oregon, that represents former and current Forest Service employees, has called for policy changes regarding the use of retardant. The group is suing the agency over employing it in and around streams and creeks. The suit has reignited debates over retardant's firefighting efficacy, and the outcome could change how it is used in the future. In a suit filed in Montana's federal district court last October, FSEEE argued that fire retardant is a pollutant, so the Forest Service needs a Clean Water Act permit if it flows into waterways. The agency is now working with the EPA to get the appropriate federal and state permits, but that process will take at least 2 years. In the meantime, the FSEEE has suggested that the use of retardant be barred within 600 feet of water, doubling the distance required by the current Forest Service policies. In a legal document filed in February, the agency said that the request could prevent pilots from using retardant at all. The only way to prevent accidental discharges of retardants to waters is to prohibit its use entirely, Jerome Perez, the National Director of Fire and Aviation Management, stated. A decision is expected before fire season starts in earnest this summer. The Forest Service considers retardant a crucial wildfire suppression tool. The substance is made up of 85% water, which helps it disperse uniformly, and 10% ammonium phosphate fertilizers. It also contains small amounts of thickeners, which help it stick to trees and bushes, as well as coloring that helps pilots see where they're dropping it. When the heat of a wildfire meets vegetation coated in retardant, the ammonium phosphate encourages organic material to release water, creating moisture that slows down combustion. But when retardant is dropped in waterways, it can be toxic to fish. After a 2011 environmental impact statement, the Forest Service required pilots to avoid applying retardant within a 300-foot buffer zone around waterways and to skirt certain habitats and populations altogether. Even so, from 2012 to 2019, the agency dropped 761,282 gallons into water, 95,708 gallons into buffer zones, and 248,285 gallons into the habitats of especially vulnerable species. The majority of incidents were accidental, but some were sanctioned exceptions. Forest Service policies consider it acceptable to drop retardant into waterways when human life or property is threatened, or when damage to natural resources outweighs loss of aquatic life, though such applications represent just 0.4% of the 279 million gallons used in those years. Despite retardants' wide use, FSEEE's executive director, Andy Stahl, questions its efficacy. I call it faith-based firefighting because there's actually no empirical evidence that retardant makes any difference in wildfire outcomes, he says. Everybody knows it's done because it looks good on CNN and because communities who feel threatened by fire want to know where the air tankers are. Stahl has written that the Forest Service has not adequately proved the fire retardant is effective at fighting wildfires. Why would we be permitting pollution that doesn't accomplish anything, Stahl says. Retardant efficacy against wildfires is difficult to measure. In the field, it's combined with other tactics such as dropping water and building fuel breaks. When a fire is successfully contained or extinguished, it's hard to credit retardant as the sole reason, and it certainly has its limits. It can only be dropped when conditions, including light, allow pilots to fly safely, and it's harder to apply in high winds. Dense tree canopy can also keep retardant from reaching the forest floor. Still, Chris Jurasek, an assistant chief tactical air operations with Cal Fire, says he and other firefighters have seen the retardant's efficacy firsthand. I know fire retardant works because for 12 years, I watched it more times than not to be effective in either slowing, controlling, or having an advantageous outcome on the incident, he says. The Forest Service declined to comment on how the agency measures retardant's effectiveness, or to answer questions about how firefighting would change if it wasn't an option. In response to FSEEE's lawsuit, U.S. representatives introduced a bill in March that would exempt fire retardant from the Clean Water Act, saying that firefighting efforts would be hampered without it. We're putting a lot of people, a lot of land, a lot of wildfire in peril, says one of the co-sponsors, Representative Doug LaMalfa, a Republican from California. If passed, the bill would be a rare exemption to the groundbreaking legislation adopted in its modern form in 1972. Mark Ryan, a retired EPA attorney who specialized in the Clean Water Act, notes that permitting retardant would be tricky. How do you write a permit for something that's being applied at 250 miles per hour in an emergency situation with very little, if any, time to assess what's really happening on the ground, he says. That's a nightmare permit to write. In a congressional hearing on the bill, Forest Service leadership painted retardant use as a matter of life and death. Fire retardant is a critical fire suppression tool that we will continue to use appropriately and widely to protect communities from the threats of wildfire, says Chris French, the deputy chief for National Forest Systems, at the hearing. We are incredibly precise and careful with our use of fire retardant. Paradise, California, which was eviscerated by a wildfire in 2018, has also defended the use of retardant. When you start putting fish above people's lives and their homes, I'm sorry, that is just not acceptable, Mayor Greg Bullen told a local TV station. Even if the Forest Service scales back retardant's use, issues remain. For one, other agencies will likely continue to use it. Cal Fire currently dispatches two air tankers with retardant to every wildfire. Other firefighting tools like foams and gels also contain chemicals. And other wildfire-caused hazards also kill fish. Tens of thousands died in the Klamath River last year after mud and ash from landslides choked the river. For now, French said, the Forest Service will continue to use the retardant until it's ordered not to. Next, Semi-Retirees Know the Key to Work-Life Balance by Kate Cray. The same day that Gail and Mark Arrowwood retired from their jobs at a Department of Energy lab, They drove to Sun Valley, Idaho, to start their next chapter, ski resort bartending. Mark had a shift that very night. Their previous roles had been intense. Over multi-decade careers, Mark had worked his way up from a janitor to a manager, and Gail had gone to night school and become a scheduler for the lab's projects. Because of how far away they'd lived from the lab, they had needed to wake up at 3 or 4 a.m. to make it in on time. They'd enjoyed aspects of the work, but their days had also been filled with office politicking and an itch to work for the next promotion. The married couple had started working at the ski resort on weekends years ago. After they decided to go to a job fair on a whim, they ended up loving their co-workers and customers, so when they retired in 2017, they saw no reason to stop. Although their old jobs could be draining, they actually looked forward to their shifts at the bar. We were desk jockeys, secretarial admin, management, and now we're hucking ice and cases of wine. We were six-figure employees, and now we're making minimum wage, Gail told me, and we love it. The Arrowwoods transition happened amid a strange economic shift in the United States. Over the past 20 years, at the same time as labor force participation rates have dropped for younger people, they've risen among older adults. Some are simply postponing their exodus from work, but for many, the line between employment and retirement is muddier. In the past month, 13% of retired Americans worked for pay, which could mean a one-off gig or a dedicated part-time job. Others are unretiring after a period away. For far too many, the decision to continue working is driven by financial necessity, an especially concerning reality given how few healthy years the average poor American has left by the time they reach retirement age. But this trend doesn't reflect other people who can't afford to quit. According to one 2014 survey, 80% of semi-retirees say they're employed because they want to be. Working after retirement is actually more common among workers with higher socioeconomic status. Though some of them might appreciate the extra income, many seem to also find those jobs enjoyable and fulfilling. The idea of a retirement purposely filled with work might seem dismal, proof that we've prioritized achievement over happiness for so long that we can't even stop in our 60s. But there might be a less pessimistic way to look at those who actively choose semi-retirement. After all, they represent a rarity in the labor market, the truly empowered worker. Examining what they get from the jobs they don't need could illuminate what a career can offer the rest of us, helping us reimagine our relationship to work long before it's time to retire. At first glance, lazing on the beach might sound more appealing than the Arrowwoods bartending gig, but days can be long and boring without work to fill them. Joe Casey, who coaches people through retirement, told me that many of his clients are scared of what will come after they leave their career. Most jobs provide structure, socialization, and even basic physical activity. When you work, there's a reason to get up in the morning, Nancy K. Schlossberg, retired expert and professor emerita of counseling psychology at the University of Maryland at College Park, explained. When people lose the community and challenge their work provided, their health, both physical and cognitive, can suffer. Of course, there are other ways to keep your brain and body healthy, such as volunteering or pursuing a hobby, but lots of jobs can be surprisingly good for you. Crucially, the jobs many semi-retirees choose aren't as demanding as the careers of their youth, or at least not in the same way. Take the Arrowwoods. At the ski resort, they have no desire to move up the management ladder. They work on a seasonal schedule that gives them plenty of vacation time to take advantage of last-minute flight deals. They enjoy perks such as free ski passes, and they consider themselves surrogate grandparents to their coworkers' kids. Maybe most importantly, knowing they could quit at any time gives them a sense of autonomy. This isn't a job of necessity, Mark told me. This is a job of desire. The experts I spoke with told me that semi-retirees tend to look for roles that grant a sense of purpose, the ability to keep learning, and, perhaps more than anything, flexibility. Most jobs come as full-time, 5-day-a-week, 40 hours at least, or more, typically more, and they don't want to work that way. They want to work differently, Phyllis Moen, a sociologist at the University of Minnesota, told me. Those lucky enough to be able to do so might use this period to pursue niche passions, fulfill lifelong dreams, or find new ones that their younger self would never have thought of. Reporting this story, I heard about an engineer who got involved in the National Park Service, a congressional researcher who trained as a massage therapist, and the vice president of a manufacturing equipment company who started hawking hot dogs at baseball games. Others might just scale back on hours at their current jobs or step away and come back later. In fact, a full 40% of employed people 65 and older were previously retired. But even a temporary retirement, rather like a sabbatical, can give people time to recharge and reevaluate what they want from a career, if they want one at all. If they return, even to a traditionally ambitious role, it might not be because they have to, but because they want to. The types of flexible gigs that many retired people look to have, historically, have been hard to come by. If they weren't, perhaps even more people would be semi-retired. One study found that about half of retirees would consider returning to work if a good opportunity came their way. But the current tight labor market is forcing some employers to be less rigid. Other trends, such as the push for a 4-day work week and the popularity of remote work, can make employment more appealing to semi-retirees. And companies that are generous to older employees tend to help younger workers, too. In her research on age-friendly workplaces in the Twin Cities, Moen found that when companies were more open to accommodating different scheduling needs or giving workers chances to learn, it opened up opportunities for everyone. Of course, some of the benefits of semi-retirement are available only to certain people, those who can afford to work in a way they actually want. And part of the magic of semi-retirement is its role as a capstone to a long career. When I asked the Arrowwoods whether they regretted their previous work, both said no. Those jobs got them where they are today. They got to be recognized for their achievements and to bolster their savings before they turned to a role that was simply fun. As today's young Americans stare down a future in which it may be common to work 60 years or more before retiring, they'll do well to figure out what they actually enjoy in a job. And plenty of them, it seems, are trying to do just that. More than 50 million people in the U.S. quit their jobs in 2022, many in search of something better, less taxing, more fulfilling, less all-consuming. Even those still striving, then, to create a career they're proud of might look to semi-retirement as a model of what could work could look like, flexible, meaningful, and with the potential for reinvention at any age. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.